Today we're going to turn our attention to the division, the final division that took place between the kingdoms of Judah and Israel. As I brought out in an earlier lecture, they were unified in a personal union by having the same ruler in the person of David, and that continued to be the case under Solomon. And last time, as we ended class, I directed your attention to 1 Kings chapter 11, because in that chapter it tells us that the actual process of bringing the punishment upon the Israelitish people because of the sins of Solomon and following after foreign gods at the behest of his wives, that it actually began while Solomon still lived. You'll notice as we go down in 1 Kings chapter 11 that there is a little bit of a recapitulation of what happened in David's day when he conquered Edom. Notice in 1 Kings 11 verse 15 it says, "It came to pass when David was in Edom, and Joab the captain of the host was gone up to bury the slain after he had smitten every male in Edom. For 6 months Joab remained there with Israel until he had cut off every male in Edom, that Hadad fled." Hadad was of the royal family of Edom, as it's explained in verse 14. "And certain Edomites of his father's servants with him to go into Egypt, Hadad being yet a little child. And they arose out of Midian and came to Paran, and they took men with them out of Paran, and they came to Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Now Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave him a house and appointed him victuals and gave him land." Now, why should the Pharaoh of Egypt take in this refugee Edomite prince and give him a house, servants, food supplies, and estates so that he would have an income on which to live? I mean, what is it to Pharaoh, this guy coming in? Why doesn't he just let him say, okay, you can come in, we'll give you asylum, but you shift for yourself? Why this generosity? Because remember that in the days of Solomon, Solomon was involved in a very rich commercial alliance with Hiram, the king of Tyre, which was in competition to the commercial alliance that existed between Egypt and the Phoenician city of Byblos. And the Egyptian pharaoh is not blind. He says, okay, this young man, I'm sorry, even back in the days of David this happened, because this has happened in the days of David when Hadad took refuge in Egypt. This alliance between David and Hiram was threatening the dominance of Egypt and Byblos' alliance. And he is sort of just saying, okay, this might prove to be useful to me in the future. This is an investment I'm going to make. Maybe I can use this Hadad as a tool to weaken David or perhaps his successor. And indeed, Hadad found such great favor in his sight of Pharaoh, as it says in verse 19, that he gave him to wife the sister of his own wife, the sister of Tahpenes, the queen. Now, it's interesting that this did pay off. This gamble, you might say, did pay off. Notice that when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers and Joab, the captain of the host, was dead, he said to Pharaoh, "Let me depart that I may go to my own country." And the Pharaoh said, "Have you lacked anything with me? Behold, you seek to go to your own country." In other words, he didn't think it was the right time to take advantage of the situation. But he insisted, and so he went. But apparently he remained very quiet. Apparently he remained very quiet until, of course, late in Solomon's reign, when the opportunity arose to cause trouble. Because he is mentioned in the context of being an adversary to Solomon late in his reign. Notice this in verse 14, going back to verse 14. "The Eternal stirred up an adversary to Solomon, Hadad the Edomite of the king's seed of Edom." So he goes back in the days of the early days of Solomon. But he sort of lies low until late in Solomon's reign. And then as Solomon's kingdom begins to lose strength, he sees his opportunity and he begins to make trouble. Now there's another adversary that God stirred up. Verse 23. "Rezin the son of Eliada, which had fled from his lord, had it Ezer the king of Zobah." Now, if you went over the chart of David's conquests, you're familiar with the fact that David defeated Hadadezer three times in battle, the final time conclusively. Hadadezer was sort of like a David, though located further north. Hadadezer had carved out a multiple kingdom where he had 32, I think it was, kings who were vassal to him in the huge area of Syria on both sides of the Euphrates River. And David had conquered him and secured those territories for himself. Now this individual was Rezon, who is the son of Eliada, who was a vassal king to Hadadezer. And he had fled when Hadadezer, of course, was defeated by David. And he gathered men to himself and became a captain over a band, sort of like the way Jephthah had been when he was thrown out of his inheritance, and sort of the way David had been when he was fleeing from Saul. But now, late in Solomon's reign, they went to Damascus and dwelt therein and reigned in Damascus. Now, how do we know that it was late in Solomon's reign that this happened? Well, because earlier in the Bible, where it describes Solomon's kingdom, it describes it as reaching from the river of Egypt all the way to the Euphrates. That's way, way beyond Damascus. So this couldn't have been the state of affairs earlier in Solomon's reign. This must be a reference to late in his reign, when he began to sin and worship foreign gods. And he was an adversary to Israel all the remaining days of Solomon, beside the mischief that Hadad did. Now, you stop to think about what is happening. Some of the vital territories that sit astride the king's highway across the Jordan River are being removed from Solomon's hand, even late in his reign. Edom is becoming independent, and Edom controls the southernmost part of the king's highway, and therefore the link with the seaport down there on the Red Sea. Damascus, of course, is at the other end of the king's highway. It is the launching off point where one goes to the major areas of Mesopotamia. So that is also being lost to Solomon. There must have been a consequent decrease in income. There must have been, as these vital territories were lost. There must have been a decrease in Solomon's income. But there does not appear to have been a decrease in Solomon's expenditures. Sort of like what we're going through now, or have been for the past maybe 10 years, as our income was getting less and less, but our expenditures kept getting to be more and more. And this needs to be understood in terms of the background of what Rehoboam faced when he went to ask the northern kings to declare their allegiance to him, when he went up to Shechem to be crowned as their king. That in itself seems rather suspect. In the sense, if you stop to think of it, when David was king over both kingdoms and he wanted to signify that Solomon was his successor, he had Solomon crowned king of both kingdoms, but he had him crowned in Jerusalem. Now Rehoboam, in order to attempt to retain the loyalty of the northern tribes, has to trek northward up to Shechem to seek a coronation there. It's like his standing with the people there is not even as high as that of his father. The situation has become much more tense. That seems to be the indication as to why he had to go up there. Now here in chapter 11, we're also introduced to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. There are many references to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, most of them bad. Notice that Jeroboam, verse 28, was a man of valor. Solomon, seeing the young man, that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. Now notice the marginal reference should say the burden of the house of Joseph. Jeroboam was over the forced labor levies. Remember, they had to perform various service in the building up of the various fortress cities that Solomon built. And this was by corvée. Everybody was subject to it, except perhaps the highest in the land as a normal routine. The nobles of the land were usually exempt, but the average person was subject to corvée at the behest of the king. In other words, he had to spend a certain amount of days a year serving as a workman in building the king's projects. And Jeroboam was put in this particular position. Now it came to pass that when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him in the way, and he had clad himself with a new garment. And they two were alone in the field. And Ahijah caught the new garment that was on him and rent it in 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, "Take you 10 pieces. For thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, Behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes to you." Whereas the northern kingdom is going to be taken away from the house of David, the southern kingdom shall be left. Notice in verse 37, it says, "I will take you, and you shall reign according to all that your soul desires, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be, if you will hearken to all that I command you, and will walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will make you a house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you." What a promise he was given. The Davidic covenant is a fantastic covenant in many ways because of its uniqueness. The promise that was given to David of that dynasty was a unique promise, and yet God offered the same thing to Jeroboam. He said, "Just as I gave David a sure house, a dynasty that would rule over Judah, until the time, of course, that, as he indicated elsewhere, the Messiah would come," he said, "I'll make a similar promise to you for the nation of Israel. Your descendants shall rule over the northern tribes without interruption all the time until the Messiah comes, if you keep my statutes and judgments." What a promise. Now, Solomon began to get a little bit concerned about Jeroboam. Apparently, Jeroboam proved to be a bit too popular, a little bit too successful, began to worry Solomon, and so Jeroboam had to flee for his life. And he fled into Egypt to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So now that Solomon is dead, Rehoboam goes up there to Shechem to be made king. We've already talked about the fact that the people there said, "Look, we were forced to serve your father in a very harsh manner. If you promise to rule with greater consideration, we will accept you as our king." And because Rehoboam was not intended to rule over the north, God allowed him to be swayed by the advice of the young men who were selfish and narrow-minded as he was. And so he told the people who came to him out of the northern tribes that he would even increase their burdens. And as a result, just as in the days of Sheba, the son of Bichri, they repeated a very similar phrase that had been repeated earlier. We find it in verse 16. "What portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, see to your own house, David." So Israel departed unto their tents. The northern kingdom withdrew their allegiance from Rehoboam. And the two kingdoms are now not just two kingdoms as they've always been since the death of Saul, but they are now following after two different leaders. Because as we see in verse 20, "It came to pass that when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, that they sent and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel," meaning the northern tribes. Now Rehoboam tried to forcefully restrain these Israelites of the north and force them to come back under his rule. But this was not the will of God, and he was told as such in verse 24. "You shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing is from me." And so they hearkened to the word of the Eternal, and they returned to depart according to the word of the Eternal. Now, Jeroboam is now established as king in the north. He has some immediate physical problems he has to resolve. Number one, he needs a capital city. Because the joint capital had been Jerusalem. Jerusalem is, of course, in the southern kingdom. He has to establish some place as a capital for this new separated, kingdom of Israel. He chose, as it says in verse 25, Shechem in Mount Ephraim. It says, he built Shechem in Mount Ephraim and dwelt therein. That became the royal capital. And he went out from there and built Penuel. Now, the implication seems to be not that he abandoned Shechem and went later to Penuel, but that he also established Penuel as a joint capital with Shechem. Now, there are several reasons why he apparently did this. The Bible doesn't tell us why, but we can figure out at least some good plausible explanations. One reason has to do with geography, and so we'll examine that in the geography class. Let's concentrate on the other. What possible reason can we ascribe to Jeroboam choosing Shechem that is not geographical but historical, as to why that would be an appropriate place for all the northern Israelite tribes to look as the place where their leadership should come from? What possible historical associations do we have there that would have served to make that a logical choice for a capital? Mr. Manamika? Okay, that was his first stop in the land, Abraham's first stop in the land, but he lived in many different places. So it would be hard to prefer that over others simply because it was the first place he stopped. Geographically, it probably would have been, had to have been. So that would not by itself, though while it's quite true there's the association with Abraham, by itself it wouldn't be sufficient. Something else of greater moment involving the tribes must have happened there that caused it to be significant enough to be revived as a location for a capital. Mr. Gardner? Right. Remember, after Joshua's initial conquest, he gathered all the tribes to Shechem, and that's where they made the covenant that they would cleave to the Eternal and that they would, you know, have that as their joint inheritance. And so, more than likely, it is that historical association that was significant enough to make them choose Shechem. Now, remember, the name of this kingdom is Israel. How does that possibly enter into a choice of Penuel as being suitable to be a royal capital city? What possible historical connection can we adduce there that would possibly explain that choice? Miriam? Okay, that's not where he had his dream. He had the dream of the vision of the angels of Machaniah, but that's where he wrestled with God and had his name changed to Israel. That's where Jacob received the name Israel, which is now the name of the kingdom. So that's a very rich historical association, and very likely is the reason why Penuel loomed large enough in the associations of the people that it would be an acceptable choice as a capital. Now, you know, we don't understand because we haven't lived in the days when a city has been chosen as a capital in the United States or in any of the countries of your residence that I'm aware of. But capitals are chosen usually with care. There are usually geopolitical reasons why they become capitals. Not just geographical, but also political. They have to be acceptable to the mass of the people. And sometimes it's the obvious choice because it's the only large city in the whole country. Other times there is a matter of pride among various cities of major importance in the country. And so a great deal of care has to go into selecting it. You have to remember that while Judah was a unit in the south, which Rehoboam was now ruling over, that the northern tribes were very fractious. There were 10 of them. And to do anything that might have tended to prefer one above another would have been a real problem. Now, this is one problem he had. But he had other problems. The bulk, of course, of the military and civil administration had been located in Jerusalem. the top levels of military and civil administration had been located there. Undoubtedly, they would have remained serving Rehoboam. That's the point that is mentioned here in verse 17 of chapter 12, that as for the children of Israel which dwelt in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. That some people who were ethnically, you know, even of the north, who were already situated because of business or government service in Judah, stayed. They didn't abandon their jobs to go back, you know, to the northern kingdom and start all over again. In the history of the United States, of course, we suffered a secessionist movement. In most cases, people went with their region, people of importance. Those who served in the U.S. Senate that came from the South, they left the U.S. Senate and went south to become part of the new Confederate States of America. Robert E. Lee was offered the command of the Union forces, but he decided that his greater loyalty was to Virginia. And so he turned down the commission and served the South. But not everyone made that decision. For instance, the man who became Lincoln's vice president in his second administration, Andrew Johnson, was from a state that seceded. And he did not go back to his home state. He stayed with the Union. You see. And I think that this was a very difficult choice, obviously, for all the people involved to make. But it indicates here in the scripture that those that were dwelling in the cities of Judah, they decided just to stay there, and they became absorbed into the tribe of Judah, apparently. Now, Jeroboam, of course, had the problem of building up a new civil and military administration. And that, of course, was a very difficult process. But then there was something else he had to worry about. Something loomed very large in his mind. The national place of worship was the temple that Solomon had built. And that was located, of course, in Jerusalem. And so it says here in the text, in verse 27 of chapter 12, if this people goes up to do sacrifice in the house of the Eternal in Jerusalem, then shall the heart of the people turn again to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, the king of Judah. He was worried that if he allowed the people of the northern kingdom, whom he was ruling, to freely go to Jerusalem to worship God in his appointed temple, that they would begin to regret the decision of separating themselves from the house of David, and they would get rid of him, and they would join themselves again to the house of David. Now, there was no reason for Jeroboam to have thought in this manner, because God, through his prophet, had vouchsafed to him that it would not happen. God had said, I do not intend for these two to be reunited again. It is my personal will that these two kingdoms remain separate. That is a given. That is my will. I will not change that. And of course, God has set his mind not to change it until, of course, the restitution of all things. When all of Israel is regathered, of course, we have the prophecy of Ezekiel, where he was told to take two sticks and label one Ephraim and his brethren, and the other Judah and his brethren, and make them one in his hand. Because God said to Ezekiel that in that time I will make them both one. And the jealousies of the former time they will no longer remember. And as Mr. Halford is very fond of quoting to me, Judah will no longer vex Ephraim. He never says the other half. Ephraim will no longer envy Judah. I guess he has his reasons. But you see, it took faith. It took faith for Jeroboam to believe that what God had said through his prophet was real. That Israel was going to remain separate. It took faith to believe that as long as he continued to obey God and follow his laws and his statutes and judgments, that he and his descendants would enjoy rule over the house of Israel, like in the case of David's house, until the time of the Messiah. It took walking by faith, and Jeroboam couldn't do it. He saw staring him in the face what looked to him to be an obvious political threat. The only thing that could have caused him to put it aside would have been the capacity to walk by faith in the promises he had been given through God's prophet. And he couldn't do it. And so he did something that was terribly wrong. And that's why throughout almost every instance later, where it talks about a king that was raised up to rule over Israel, or a king who just succeeded to the throne by right of inheritance over Israel, it says, but he continued in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, in which he caused Israel to sin. That's why Jeroboam's name appears so frequently in Scripture, even centuries after his death. Is he set Israel along a path of a corrupt form of Yahweh worship that no other king who followed him of any house ever reversed. Now, what did he do? Because he was afraid to let the people go to Jerusalem to worship, he provided them alternative places for them to worship God. He chose two places. It says here in verse 28 that he took counsel and made two calves or oxen of gold. And he said to them, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel and the other he put in Dan. Now this is not idol worship of a foreign god. This is Yahweh worship through the worship of the golden calves. It is a breaking, of course, of the commandment of not making idols to worship the true God, or as well as making idols to worship others. Now, why did he choose Bethel, and why did he choose Dan? Now, there are geographic reasons, of course, and we'll talk about those as well in the geography class, but there are also precedents. You may recall my having made the statement when we talked about the patriarchs, that there was this very strong belief in the peoples of this age that, which actually persists even into our fairly modern times, that ground which is used for worship is considered different, is considered holy. And that even if you have a different religious faith, it is appropriate to worship in the same place because it's already established as the appropriate place of worship. And I think I gave you the example of how in Damascus there is a mosque where under the mosque there are ruins of a Crusader church and under those of a Byzantine church and under those a temple to Jupiter, a Roman temple to Jupiter, and under that a Greek Hellenistic temple to Zeus, and under that a temple to the Aramean god Hadad Rimmon. All in the same general location, not square one on top of each other, but, you know, in basically the same small area, because it was considered holy ground. Indeed, I was reminded of that when I read the paper just Sunday. It's a very fine article in the View section about a man who's a Chicano who is involved very heavily in the excavation of the great temple of Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, as it was known by the Aztecs. The main temple of the Aztec city of Mexico City. And it was found just behind the main cathedral. Not surprising, you see, because this idea of establishing a place of worship which is already considered holy was used even by the Catholics, you see. Sometimes they literally turned pagan temples into churches. And this is just a practice that they followed in Europe during the, what we call the early part of the Dark Ages. And this was something that apparently was done in Mexico as well, as at least not using the temple because it was inappropriate on this top of this big pyramid, which the Aztecs had used. But after they had sort of reduced it, they had built the cathedral in basically the same place. So what is it about Dan that makes it an appropriate place to establish a national shrine? What is it that makes it holy and therefore appropriate to establish a national shrine? Okay, there was a natural spring, a very prodigious spring, that is one of the major sources of the Jordan River. And the ancient peoples did not understand springs. Ancient peoples had this concept that if a spring came gushing out of the ground or out of the side of a rock face, that either a god lived there or a god had uniquely favored that spot and had put his name there. Indeed, there is a spot in the north of what is now Israel today. It's actually, I'm not sure if it's really part of Israel or part of the occupied Golan Heights, which is called Banyas. It is the site of a New Testament city of Caesarea Philippi. But Banyas is the Arabic name, which is a variation on the Hellenistic name of Peneus. It was an important Hellenistic city, named in honor of the god Pan, the god of woodlands and springs, because of the very prodigious spring that exists there, gushing right out of the rock. Again, one of the major sources of the Jordan, honored by pagans in this case. But what also, besides the presence of the spring, made it appropriate for Jeroboam to establish a national shrine there, besides the fact that it seemed to indicate, according to the way they looked at things, that God had uniquely selected that place? The tribe of Dan had had a tribal shrine there ever since the days of the Judges. When they made their northward migration, they abducted this Levite who was serving as a house priest in Mount Ephraim. They took him and the ephod and all of his equipment, and they took him north to serve as a priest to their entire tribe. That was the man who, of course, was a descendant of Moses. We covered that earlier. And so there already was a great tribal shrine there. And because of the spring, it seems to those people that that was a place that was appropriate to worship, because God seemed to have made that place very special. Now let's consider the matter of Bethel. Is there anything which made Bethel sanctified in any way? Do we have any association where Bethel is in some way sanctified? Specifically Bethel itself. Abraham, remember, dwelt between Bethel and Ai. He did not dwell at Bethel. But we have something which sanctifies it. George? Right, that's where Jacob had his very famous dream of the ladder with the angels going up and down between heaven and earth. And in the morning when he awoke, Jacob not only made a vow to God, but he also anointed the stone on which he had been lying and set it up. He consecrated it, you see. It was sanctified because of that experience. And this, therefore, made it an appropriate place to establish a shrine for the entire nation. Now, I'm sure that these two places were chosen in part for reasons like this, but undoubtedly geography played a part as well, and we'll take a look at that in the geography class. Verse 30 of chapter 12 says, "This thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even to Dan." And then it goes on and says, "He made a house of high places and made priests of the lowest of the people, who weren't even of the sons of Levi." See, according to God's instruction, the house of Aaron, which is just a part of the tribe of Levi, was the only acceptable family from which priests could come. Then the rest of the tribe of Levi was supposed to serve as workers at the sanctuary and teachers and judges
in terms of what God's law meant. They were the custodians of it under the priests. Why is it that Jeroboam rejects those people and chooses instead to make a new priesthood, and not just make a new priesthood, but chooses the basis of the people to elevate to this very high office of being priests at the two shrines? What is going on in his head? What is he thinking about? Bill? Not only the most uninformed, you're right about that, so he could control them, but what else would give him strong measure of control over them? Right? Because they were nobody. Socially, they were nothing. They were not only undoubtedly poor, but they had no status in the society. And now they are given perhaps the highest status in the entire nation, as well as a very fine income, guaranteed to them and their descendants, if they remain loyal to the king. Because he has made them, he can unmake them. You see, the priests of the house of Aaron, even if they had been inclined to go along with this, and the Levites, even if they had been inclined to go along with this, would not have owed their positions to the king. The reason they would have occupied their positions would have been by rightful descent. That could have made them too independent, you see. But by rejecting those groups, and by taking people who socially were nothing and elevating them to this very high status, it became very clear that the king had the right to make anyone he wanted a priest, and therefore he could unmake them just as quickly. And if they wanted to remain in this very high office with the nice salaries and living, high living associated with it, and they wanted their descendants to enjoy the same status, they better follow the party line. They better, you know, do just like the priests in the neighbor countries. Just say whatever the king wants to hear. Do whatever the king wants done. Don't make waves. And then they would be guaranteed this high status and this high living. Obviously, this had to be done in such a way that it didn't instigate a huge murmur of discontent from the people of the north. Undoubtedly, there must have been some who didn't like it. And just as it says that the Levites, many of them would have left, you know, because not having any employment, but going down to the temple in Jerusalem, and many of the priests who might have been up there would have gone down to Jerusalem. There may have been some that went down to the general people. But the majority were convinced that this was not in any way wrong, and therefore accepted it. Undoubtedly, the apostasy of Solomon late in his reign must have done a lot of damage. It must have done a lot of damage. You know, it says in Timothy, if I can find it, I hadn't thought of bringing it in this connection, but let me see if I can find it. I think it's 1 Timothy 4, my memory serves me. 1 Timothy 4.
Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith,
giving heed to the seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, and this is the key point I want to emphasize, having their conscience seared with a hot iron. What does it mean to have your conscience seared with a hot iron? It means the same thing as what happens to all of us when we get a burn. We develop scar tissue. The normal skin, if the burn is serious enough, doesn't burn back without a trace of the damage. We get scar tissue. If the burn is extensive enough over a wide enough area and bad enough, you have a big mass of scar tissue. There's one big difference between scar tissue and regular tissue. What is it? It doesn't have the sensitivity of normal tissue. You don't have the nerve endings. You take your finger, which is normal, and put it on a hot stove, get a very quick message, it's hot, you pull it away. You know, get away from that. But when the scar tissue makes contact with something that's hot, it doesn't get the same message. There's no real warning. It stays there in contact with the heat and can be very severely damaged. And it's the same thing with our minds. As we are staying close to God and His ways, and we begin to stray, we become aware of it fairly quickly. We begin to realize we shouldn't be doing what we're doing, or become edgy or uncertain whether we should be doing what we're doing. At least that uncertainty enters in. But if we keep doing the thing repetitively, pretty soon we don't get that warning message anymore. It just seems to get dimmer and dimmer, and we don't hear it anymore. We are putting scar tissue in our minds, you might say, in our consciences. That's why in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 19, it's talking about these Gentiles who were blinded, you know, of what kind of life they should live. It says, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness. They couldn't feel the wrongness of it. There was no warning message that said, this is not right. They could no longer see that what they were doing, the way of life they were living, was a way that was very, very wrong. There was absolutely no warning at all. Now, it could very well be, and I strongly suspect that's the case, that because of the sins of the last years of Solomon, the consciences of his people were severely damaged. More so in the north for one major reason. Remember that David had brought into the sway, the political domination of his kingdom, the Canaanites who had remained in the land, who had been unconquered up to that time. The vast majority of those Canaanites lived in the north. And so already they represented a group that was not really sincerely devoted to Yahweh. They were sort of itching to do something different. And this, coupled with the sins of Solomon's late years, and the problems that would have resulted, make it not surprising that Jeroboam could convince people that this was not a significant departure. Sure, God has established that temple there through Solomon in Jerusalem to be worshipped, but we can establish our own temples to worship Yahweh. We're not going to worship Baal. We're going to worship Yahweh. We're just going to do it in a slightly different way and in a slightly different place. And after all, Yahweh's been worshipped at that sanctuary in Dan for centuries. God hasn't struck down the sanctuary and destroyed it. Obviously, he hasn't been displeased, so what's wrong with it? You see, ideas like this would have easily convinced the people that it was all right, that there was nothing wrong with it. Remember in the days of the judges, when the judge died, it wasn't very long before the whole people began to go into apostasy again. That where there isn't vigorous leadership, people drift away. And if you doubt that, consider a certain point in Mr. Armstrong's life, when he was concerned with only certain limited areas of the work, how much drift there was. Not just in those serving in the work, but also in the church at large. And it was only when he was brought back from death and was made to see by God opening his mind what was happening and took very vigorous action that the church began to be put back on track. As I say, without this continual dynamic leadership, the knowledge of God's ways does not naturally of itself remain strong, even when you're dealing with people who are, by and large, converted. It can happen to us, too. So it's not that hard to understand. And then, of course, he went one step further. In verse 32, we read about it in chapter 12, 1 Kings 12, verse 32. Jeroboam ordained a feast in the eighth month, on the 15th day of the month, like to the feast that is in Judah. In other words, the Feast of Tabernacles was moved from the 15th day of the seventh month to the 15th day of the eighth month. And he himself offered upon the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. So he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the eighth month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart, and ordained a feast to the children of Israel, offering upon the altar and burning incense. He's becoming just like a king in the surrounding nations. He appoints the priests, he controls them totally, and he exercises the high priest's office himself. Total departure from the way God had established monarchy in Israel.
in the days of Samuel. For these things were not to be done. And the people accepted it, by and large. What was the net effect of the split of the kingdoms and the consequent warfare that broke out between the two of them that existed for several generations? The answer is a continuation of what had begun in the days of Solomon. Not only had Edom and Damascus broken away, but eventually Ammon and Moab broke away as well. And with them, the Philistines became independent, and the Phoenicians no longer saw any usefulness in maintaining a commercial alliance, because they did not dominate the trade routes anymore. And so they lost their very profitable commercial alliance with Tyre, and the whole economy took a deep dive. Economically, everything turned downhill. There would be in the future history of Israel and Judah two periods when they would both be very prosperous. And those two periods of great prosperity share one common characteristic. In both of those later periods, Israel and Judah would cooperate rather than fight with each other, and together would dominate all the surrounding nations, thus controlling the land trade routes. And as a result, they would enjoy an alliance with Tyre. And when they would lose either the trade routes or the mutual assistance pact, you might say, between Israel and Judah, they would lose their prosperity again. And so we will see, as we come to it in later lectures, that those two greater periods of prosperity hinge upon the things that Solomon had forged. The control, rather, David had forged and Solomon inherited. The control of the land trade routes, because they controlled all the surrounding countries, and the commercial alliance with Tyre. But for now, that was gone. And Israel and Judah had to make do with a much lower standard of living.